Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Wait What If podcast. These intros are kind of tricky to record because I either do it before or after the conversation. If I do it before, I don't know how the conversation went, so I can only pretend that the next conversation is going to be really good. Or I already know how it went, but I want to pretend that I don't know how it went. So your question is going to be right now, am I talking before or after I actually had this conversation with Scott Sentence? Anyways, with us today is, or will be, or was, Scott Santons, who has an impressive resume to include a psychology degree from the U of Washington. He worked as a research assistant at the HINTS Lab, which is the Human Interaction with Nature and Technology Systems. He is a writer for Huffington Post, TechCrunch, the Boston Globe, Basic Income, Earth Network, Cracked, the News Hub, to name a few. And he's pretty much active on every single social media site that there's out there. If you're a Reddit fan, which I am, he's on. He's the moderator for r/basicincome, and yeah, that's about it. So, without further ado, let's talk to Scott. Oh, he's going to talk to us today about universal basic income, and I guess part of me should be completely against it because I'm a libertarian and I should be like, no, stay out of our lives. But you'd be surprised, there's some parts of this that are very libertarian-esque. So keep your mind open. I'm not sure how I feel about it, but keep your mind open and we're going to have a cool conversation.
You're listening to the Wait What If podcast.
Cool. Hey, you know what? Before we start, I was going to bring up that I really enjoyed the way we set up the interview with Calendy, that I'm going to set up my own account there because that thing works fantastic. But but I thought about how ironic it is that it totally automated the whole scheduling process. And,
exactly.
And you and I just pretty much got rid of a personal assistant or a secretary or something like that. So right now we are playing into the need for perhaps universal basic income.
Right, right. You know, there's so many things out there. You know, it also shows too that people don't even know that stuff like this exists.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not that you know, you don't even need like an artificial intelligence assistant. This is just like saying, hey, you can just select the meeting time yourself and it'll go into my calendar.
Right, right.
And they're like, oh, so like that technology is not like super advanced or anything. It's just a smart way of going about it.
And you know, have you ever heard the analogy of a frog sitting in a boiling, or not even a boiling, a warm pot of water, and you slowly turn up? Yeah, it's kind of like that, because I think about when my dad was, or when I was younger, and my dad had an office, you know, there was a secretary, and she handled, all the calls went through her, and it would get pushed back to him if he needed to take the call or whatever. And now, you know, I run an office, and I don't have a secretary, because everything comes through, you know, either my cell phone, and I can push it on mute and private and whatever, and I can schedule my whole day out. I have reminders, and I even have a smart watch that is tapping me on the shoulder to tell me, you know, to do different things. And it's that slow process. I mean, I'm 40 years old, so we can say over the last 30 years that heat has been turned up, and we're slowly seeing the, I guess, degradation of, I wouldn't call it degradation, maybe the elimination of certain jobs that were once indispensable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a big transformation going on. It's been going on for decades.
Now, where I already recorded the introduction, but you know, I see that you're a writer and all that, and your degree is in psychology. But where did your interest in this topic, universal basic income, come from?
Well, yeah, it came from Reddit, actually. That's where the a discussion hit the front page. Back in 2013, and it was about technology. It was about you know, how people have no idea how quickly technology is advancing. And I had been someone, you know, I've always followed technology, and you know, I thought I knew a good idea of what all was going on. But that really, there was some stuff in there that really surprised me. And so, like, one of those things that really surprised me was how there were already self-driving trucks being implemented, you know, in the mines of Rio Tinto. And so this company had an entire plan of automating their entire fleet at this mine 100% by 2020. That was their plan, and they were already like 20% of the way there or something like that back in 2013. And so, you know, that was like, holy crap, like, we just developed self-driving cars, like, just like a few years before, really, was when that, you know, that self-driving contest with the put on by DARPA had just been won, and, you know, Google was still new into this, and here we have these self-driving trucks already.
Yeah, and it's,
so that really,
well, yeah, I was just going to say, it's coming so quick too.
Yeah, exactly. It's just happening really fast. So then I started looking into, well, you know, this seems to be that we're going towards a kind of a divergent branching path where we're not really, we can't really continue on. These choices are being made essentially for us, and it's like we can either go in a dystopian direction or we can go in a utopian direction. Like, we can choose if things are going to get worse for us or better for us, but the status quo is coming to an end. And that got me looking into what our possibilities were, which led me to basic income. And then I started really studying that. And then when I started really studying it and seeing it, like, how much evidence there is for it and just like the past, like the history of it and how many different things it could impact and affect, especially, like, again, with my background in psychology, I started seeing this through this kind of shift in motivational perspective and the shift in how we treat each other and how we think. And, you know, they kind of open it up as a, holy crap, like, this is not only an idea that would improve the future and prevent, like, some really poor outcomes, eventually, like, social breakdown, but it could actually create, like, a better, essentially, like, civilization. I mean, this would be a huge difference across a wide variety of factors.
To go back on the technology part, this theme comes up quite a bit on my show. But so what we fail to realize, and unless you stop and think about it, is the exponential growth of technology.
Yes, we
tend to look back and say, okay, like, I'm 40 years old and I can see how much tech has changed over my lifetime. But what I really need to do is look how much tech has changed over the past 10 years, or look how much has changed over the past 5 years. And to look forward, you have to, it's not even something you can really imagine, because we're going to see the same amount of technological advancement that we saw in the first or the last 100 years of the 20th century in the next maybe 5 years. And then beyond that, we're going to see it in the next 2.5 years, which is why when you hear about the major automobile companies, they're not talking, you know, the typical thing is to say, oh, in 20 or 25 years, but no, they're talking 2 or 3 years. I think Tesla wants to get one on the road next year.
Yeah. Elon Musk has really, it's been funny too, seeing his projections, like, kind of like scooch up instead of back. Like, we're really used to being able, saying like, oh, well, we can have cars by, self-driving cars by 2025. And then, like, they'll talk to them a year later and they'll be like, well, we maybe more like 2030 or something. But it's like, it's not like that. When it comes to Elon Musk, he's like, well, we can do this by 2020. And then you talk to him again, he's like, I think we'll have it by 2019. And, I think like late 2018.
Yeah, which is kind of, and I guess that speaks for the exponential growth of technology.
And the fact that he really wants to do this too. It's not like he's just kind of blowing smoke. He thinks that this is a really good idea, and the things that he's doing, he believes are important to humanity as well. Like, he's got like larger long term visions.
Sure.
And he's thinking like, yeah, let's do this as soon as we can.
And I'm fine with that, because I have stock in Tesla, so he can I think there's like a generation, or yeah, I guess you could call it a generational disconnect between I guess the reality of our future. For an example, I guess is I'm always arguing with my father-in-law, who's 70 years old, about how I can't wait for autonomous vehicles, especially the fact that I have two little kids. To me, it's like they can't come soon enough. And he is under the idea or the mentality that no way am I ever going to take my hand off the steering wheel of a car. But when you look at the numbers, right, it can you can look at it, I guess, in any aspect of life. If you take 29,000 deaths off the road, you know, per year, then it's a no-brainer that you're going to go with the newer technology. And with that, and kind of, I guess, a couple on the back of that, there's really, it's hard to find a safe career that won't be damaged by, or I guess damaged, eliminated by technology. I'm in medicine. I work in medicine. But let's say I need my heart transplanted on, and I have a choice between a doctor who has 35 years of cardiology experience or a machine that has the collective knowledge of, say, 1,000 years of experience. The machine doesn't fatigue. The machine doesn't argue with his wife. The machine doesn't, have anything going on except it has to fix me. I'm going to choose the machine. And yeah. I think it would be silly not to.
Yeah, yeah. This is really, you know, looking into just this, kind of generational shift of technology where it's always, you know, if you're older, it's harder to change and to look at something, even if it works better. You know, like how many people in their, say, 80s or 90s are still not on the internet or not using a smartphone, or there's a certain uptake that only happens, that especially happens if you're younger. And like when it comes to like the self-driving cars, it's dangerous. It's more dangerous for humans to be driving. Like this, we're bad at it. Like there are so many deaths, there are so many accidents, all it takes is just driving around and every day I'm seeing stuff where it's like, oh my gosh, that person should not be driving. That's a terrible driver. Uh-huh. Why did this person do that? Why did this person do this? And you see like people doing angry things like, oh, there's some road rage, and oh, this person is like, you know, tailing this person because they're mad at them. Like, we're terrible. We bring emotion into this. And a machine would not do that. And if you even look at, like, it was horrible with the first like death from the Tesla autopilot. That's horrible. But then if you look at the amount of miles and then deaths per mile with this, it was already safer. Like there had been fewer deaths using this new tool than otherwise.
Well, yeah.
And look, so even though it's horrible, but like,
look at the internal combustion engine when cars first came on, you know, I mean, they were killing more people than horses were. And then you also have to look at it. There's a great TEDx talk where they talk about where we are in self-driving cars. And the thing to look at is, is the difference between autonomous driving and assisted driving. And he was killed with assisted driving. So there's still a 90% human, actually I would say 100%, because you're monitoring the systems that are assisting you. So that drive, although it was caused by an autonomous system, was supposed to be monitored by humans, and he screwed up. Because I think he was asleep.
That he was, you know, it's just, you get used to, you're told that you can't, you know, just let the car drive itself completely. And, you know, you might think about like, oh, well, yeah, they're just saying that to cover their asses. You know, I'm sure it's fine. You do this and it's fine. But then, yeah, sure, there are these kind of edge cases, and that just happened to be a fatal mistake. Yeah. But and again, it's terrible. But at the same time, it's already saving people, because you've also seen these collisions and stuff avoided by this that have been recorded. And there's also people that not talking about the stuff where like, oh, like, who knows how, you know, an accident may have happened had the autopilot not been, you know, engaged at this. You know, you don't even notice it. You're just like, oh, that's just driving.
And I've been driving for I don't even know how many years, 20 something. And how many times, I don't know how long you've been driving, how many times have you gone, wow, that was close? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Or you didn't even see something. On that TED Talks, the guy's talking in the background. There's like a computer. I don't even want to say it's an animation. I want to say it's exactly what the car was seeing during its driving. And it sees everything. I mean, stuff that you don't even see, you couldn't see, this thing is picking up on.
It's superhuman. It responds faster. Mm-hmm. It, And it's feeding off of our data too, which is another big thing, is that there is an exponential learning to this. And as you mentioned, like with a doctor, is that you can use a deep learning thing to train, say, a robotic doctor or not just to diagnose something. But like it's learning from all this data that we're already doing. And as it continues on, and let's say if a self-driving car or algorithm learns something along the way, then suddenly, like when it comes to a human being, that person would learn from that. It'd be like, oh, I'm never doing that again. Like he learned that lesson.
Right.
But it doesn't go to everyone else. But when it comes to self-driving cars and these kind of deep learning algorithms, that extends to everything in the entire network. So one thing learns something from its experience, and then suddenly every single car will not make that mistake again because they've all learned it. And so you've got this really quickly exponential growth with this ability to improve that's completely unmatchable by humans.
Wow. So automation, we're thinking in the next, and I've read some studies that say in the next 15 years, we're going to lose 30 to 40% of our jobs. And others that say in the next 50 to 100 years, we're going to lose 50% of our jobs. Either way, within the next half century, we're going to see a large chunk of the population unemployed. Maybe. I say maybe because there's two things. Can we not, is this a definite, number one? Because that would be like if we traveled in the future with everyone right now, 30 to 40% of people would lose their jobs, right? But if we develop into this future of automation, then yes, those jobs will be lost, just as the guy who ran the tender box on a coal run train's job was lost. But he eventually found other employment through other means. So I guess my question is this a definite? Are we going to have a mass unemployment in the next 50 years? Or are we kind of being a little alarmist and we might see some unemployment, but we're going to see some people adjusting to it?
Okay, so first of all, I think we're looking at this the wrong way because we require jobs in order to live, essentially. And so, you know, the question I want to ask is why do we have so many jobs right now? Like, and why is it that we're actually worried about losing them? Like, why is it that the prospect of half as many jobs in 20 years is something that's scary? And it's something that we're thinking, oh my gosh, like what's going to happen to us? And is this going to happen or not? Like, I want us to ask the question, like, shouldn't this be a good thing? Like, shouldn't we want to automate as much of this, you know, toil, this involuntary work, you know, this stuff that, you know, only 30% of people right now are in the U.S. are engaged by what they do, and worldwide it's 15%. So hardly anybody really is engaged by what they're doing. It's not something that really adds value to people's lives is doing this stuff. At the same time, our productivity has been going up decade after decade after decade, which is, it's so weird to think that here we are, we're about three times as productive as we were from back in the 70s, which means that we're all doing three times as much for the same amount of time and effort. And yet, we're actually having to work even more. Like back in the day, you only needed, say, one primary earner in a household in order to live like a middle class life. Mm-hmm. And now people have to have, say, two primary earners in a household, and you're not even guaranteed a middle class life, even with that, which is so weird because here we are and we're so much more productive than they were decades ago. So, what's going on here? And I think, you know, when you look back and people say, it's been said before that, you know, that all the jobs would be gone and that we'd all be working 15-hour work weeks, you know, like, and that was wrong. And I want to suggest that maybe if we had decoupled work from income all those years ago, that we actually, that would be where we're at right now. Like, we just, as long as you require people to have a job, you'll always come up with another job, no matter how ridiculous or unnecessary or hated or whatever it is. You have to do it. And so I think we've essentially been generating jobs that don't need to exist. And I think we've been not allowing people to work less and share the labor more. So another question is, you know, why is it that we're afraid of, say, everyone being unemployed? Because if there's half as much work, paid work to do in 20 years, then that also means that we could all work half as much. I mean, we could all have a 20-hour work week instead of a 40-hour work week, and everyone would be just as employed. We'd just be sharing the available labor more. You'd have more free time to pursue what people want to pursue. And people would be doing the work that they feel is important to them. I think, you know, it'd be the reverse. You wouldn't have this case now where only 30% of people are engaged by what they do. You'd have people more like 100% engaged by what they do, because if you had a basic income and you had this free time because you weren't forced to do, you know, all this stuff in order to live, that you could actually be pursuing the work that's valuable to you. And I think that is what the work that we want to enable, and that's the work that's, you know, that's the work that people are best at. Is you don't want people doing stuff that they hate. You want robots to be doing that stuff. You want algorithms to be doing that stuff. You want people doing what they are actually motivated by intrinsically. That's like the best work that's going to be done, and that's like the most, you know, the most passionate stuff. It'll be of the highest quality. People will really be driven by that. So I just want to, you know, flip this around and just say, what isn't going on right now because we haven't decoupled income from work, and not like, do we think that we'll need to decouple income from work in order to survive?
How does this fit with, the market, the capitalism? Like if 50% of the people said, I don't like this job, I'm going to back out of it, and I'm going to, you know, basket weave because that's where my passion is. And now, the market doesn't call for 50% of the labor to be basket weaving or in the arts. So, where does that leave an individual? You know?
So this is where it gets really interesting, is when we're looking at motivation. And again, so this is, you know, from my psychology background, this is what kind of fascinates me.
Right.
Is that, you know, so right now we are essentially forcing people to work because you don't necessarily have the choice not to. And because of that, you will work, say, $5 an hour or $6 an hour. You know, it's poverty wages, but you'll accept it because you have no other choice.
Right.
So if you can actually say no to this stuff, and if you can say, you know, like, I have a basic income, it's not a lot, but it's enough to eat and sleep indoors, you know, it's fine. But like, I'll do that job that you're offering if you offer it for $15 an hour or $20 an hour, like, I'll do that. Or, you know, I won't work your job for 40 hours a week, but I'd be happy to do it for 15 hours a week. You know, I'll work part-time. Like, it moves the incentive to the employer instead of the employee to take this. So, like, it's the employer's job to incentivize work once people have a basic income and the ability to say no. So that's, like, I think that's actually a more free market for labor. So there's this complaint right now, you know, about with minimum wages. So that's a distortion of the labor market. It's saying that even though this work isn't technically worth, say, $15 an hour, let's actually mandate it so that it has to be $15 an hour. And then that kind of changes, you know, the prices, and it changes the amount of people that would be working. And so, like, it's distortionary. But people who really care about, say, free markets and stuff, they want people to be able to choose this stuff voluntarily. So if you can actually, say, refuse low-demand jobs, then technically speaking, when you look at supply and demand, a low-demand job should actually pay a lot more in order to get that supply. And if you have a high-demand job where a lot of people love doing, those are the jobs that can actually pay less, because you shouldn't have to pay as much to do them because people really want to do them intrinsically. So it changes the way the labor market works, where as right now, the worst jobs pay the least and the best jobs pay the most. And that could actually reverse it so that the worst jobs pay a lot more and the best jobs pay a little less. Like, that seems to make more sense to those who look at, you know, the dynamics of, like, free market capitalism.
How do you answer to the argument, and I honestly don't have an economic background, I have a history and medical background, but I've heard the argument with if everyone has a basic income, or let's say we drive the minimum wage up to $15, it resets the zero mark. And now the zero mark is, say, $30,000 a year. And the only way you are actually considered to have means to take care of yourself is if you're making $40,000 a year. And that's the poverty line now, $40,000.
Yeah. I call that the new zero argument. It's a very common first response to the idea of basic income. It's like, you know, it's a very common question. What about rising prices? What about inflation? And so one of the first things I wrote that really looked into this was about that question, because I really wanted to analyze that. And so it's not a simple response to that, except for, you know, if you really wanted to summarize it, it would be something along the lines of it's possible, but it's highly unlikely that it would have any effect to the degree that someone fears it would. So whereas there's no way that you're eroding the entire basic income from introducing a basic income, even if it's due to higher prices. But then you have to look at, you know, what are the likelihoods of higher prices, and which were those higher prices before? You know, where there's a whole lot of variance. There's a whole lot of variables in this equation. Mm-hmm. So to kind of just shortly break this down, the first major important point to remember is that when it comes to basic income, for the most part, you know, we could print a whole bunch of money. We could do this through monetary expansion, but that's not the way that most people are talking about it. What we're mostly talking about is a transfer of income from, say, the top 20% to the bottom 60%, effectively. It's a transfer of existing income. It's not monetary expansion. So it's not that there are more dollars chasing the same amount of goods, which is what would usually, you know, be typically a cause of inflation. It's the same amount of dollars chasing the same amount of goods, but there's dollars in different hands. So instead of the dollar being up at the top, let's say locked away in a bank somewhere, not doing anything, or stuffed in somebody's mattress or something, effectively, that it's actually in the hands of people who are using it and driving the economy. Okay. And so then you're another effect of that are you have these multiplier effects too. And so, you know, when it comes to the effectiveness of a dollar, you know, it's compared to, like, say, you know, to the effect of GDP, you know, say a dollar in the hands of someone on Wall Street is worth about an extra 39 cents to the economy. And the same dollar in the hands of a minimum wage worker is worth about $1.21 to the economy. So it's about three times more effective. It's more stimulative to have this money at the bottom than the top. And so you have this expression of demand that's not being expressed currently, because people don't have the money to express it, and that would actually cause an increase in supply as well. Because if you're a company, you want more customers. Like, let's say you're producing 100 widgets right now, and suddenly the demand for widgets goes up. So you want to produce more of those widgets, and you will do that. And so at the economy, if you look at it right now, we're not at full production capacity. Like, we could produce more, but we're not. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to people having more money to express demand, it's not a sure thing that supply will not be able to meet it. If supply can be ramped up, you're not going to see increases in prices. In fact, you can actually see decreases in prices, for the same reason why you can get stuff cheaper at Costco, you know, than you can individually somewhere else. Like, you save money through this, you know, bulk kind of system. You know, there are savings there. You know, it's why you can produce a car for $20,000, you know, if you make this many. But if you make, say, five times as many, then you can sell that car for less than that. Mm-hmm. So that's another part of this as well, is that you will actually increase the demand, and therefore increase the supply for a lot of things that can do that. What you're looking at is the inability to increase supply, which is mostly, you know, stuff with, like, you're definitely not looking at digital goods. You're looking at stuff, because that's infinite supply. You're looking at stuff like handmade luxury goods or something, or like, you know, there's only one painting, you know, that's by Rembrandt called this or whatever, and so more demand for that is just going to rack up the price. But that's not the way it works for most stuff. It's just like these limited supply things. So it's possible that the prices of, say, luxury goods and stuff like that could go up with a basic income. But that's not what a lot of people at the bottom are buying. You know, most of this stuff is normal, everyday stuff that we can totally make plenty of. You know, it seems ridiculous that, you know, that we're essentially wasting about half of our food supply. It's just because, you know, we create it and it ends up in the garbage. At the same time, people are going to food banks, and you know, there's hunger. And so it's not because people don't have the demand for food. It's that they don't have the ability to signal their demand for it and actually access it with money. And another important part of this as well is your competition aspect. So if there's competition, you're not going to be able to raise prices. It's only if you have a monopoly or if there's some kind of regulated system or price fixing or some kind of cartel or whatever that you would have rising prices, because all it takes is one person. Like, you imagine, the fear is that milk would go up to $6 or let's say $8 a gallon after basic income, because these companies or businesses know that people have more money. Well, all it takes is one person, one company to say, well, actually, we're going to lower our prices. And suddenly those other companies who are greedy go out of business. And, a real life example of this too is in Alaska, which is the closest thing to universal basic income in the world, where everyone gets this annual dividend of say about $1,000 a year on average to spend on anything they want to. And it's a universal thing. And so when they receive that once a year, there's actually a lot of sales and stuff. So people lower their prices, these businesses lower their prices in the hopes that they're the ones that can attract this money to their businesses. It's not, they don't do the opposite. They don't say, oh, well, everyone got their checks, so let's actually raise the prices of stuff so we can get even richer. Like, they know that that would be stupid because people wouldn't go there. They'd go to the ones doing sales. So there's a lot of interesting details to the inflation question that really it is a lot of stuff.
It's not an easy thing to I guess.
Right.
So here's another question. Looking at our culture, looking at the American culture, and it shifts and the paradigm shifts all the time. But it takes a while, and it's usually the result of something. Our culture tends to be very competitive. It tends to be very profit-driven, tends to also be reward-driven, tends to be hard work-driven. Even if someone is, let's say that we can have more free time, people might not accept that. A lot of people might want to, I guess, for the sense of purpose, to be working the hours that they're working, or at least to sweat and toil. I guess maybe it's our monkey minds, if we have monkey brains still, that, the need to provide and to work at it. Do you think that can happen? Or do you think that maybe we have to experience a little bit of pain before this shift occurs?
Well, okay, so I think we're already seeing a shift, especially with the younger generation. We're seeing this growth of the sharing economy. Like, we're seeing people engage in stuff and with each other for free, without any importance of being paid or paying or whatever. So, mm-hmm. Take example of looking at just podcasts. So look at YouTube, what people are doing there, or right. Even look at something like Snapchat. Where you've got people looking at their stories, and we all have a limited amount of time, and it seems like people are using more and more of their time to they're not watching necessarily like TVs and movies. They're consuming a lot of this free kind of content that we're all co-creating. Mm-hmm. You spend a lot of time on Facebook, a lot of time communicating on Snapchat, a lot of time watching YouTube videos and stuff, and so all of this is being created for free. If people aren't doing it, they're not seeing it as a job. They're doing it because it's meaningful to them. There's some kind of purpose. It's just fun. But at the same time, it's obviously worth something because people are getting very rich off this. How much Snapchat is worth, how much Facebook is worth, how much Google is worth. And a lot of this stuff is just using the data that we're creating for free, and it's leveraging that. And, you know, we're not seeing any part of that, but I would say that that's work. So it's really, we're not seeing valuable work as valuable work. And I think that we will see that more and more, especially the basic income, where we, you know, there's so much unpaid work going on. Like, there's analysis done about just looking at the amount of unpaid care work in the U.S. and it says what could be that compared to, and it came up with around $700 billion per year of unpaid care work is going on. So, you know, that's people looking after their friends' kids or their nieces and nephews, or you know, an older couple, like one part looking at the other spouse as you know, when they're sick or something. Mm-hmm. Like there's a whole lot of this unpaid work that's extremely valuable going on, but we don't see it that way because it doesn't get earned a paycheck.
Right.
And so I think that there's, you know, this worry that we're not going to have anything to do when, say, if the working hours shrink down, or if people have the ability to not take a job and actually can pursue their own work, I think that we're looking at intrinsically motivated work. People are not going to just do nothing. They're going to do what they choose is important to them, just like we do now. Like, can you imagine? Like, no one really worries about when the weekend comes, like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do this weekend? I've got nothing to do because I don't have my job. Like, even if you're someone who believes that and doesn't want to, say, relax and spend time with friends or something, like, those are the people who are even taking up hobbies and they, like, build furniture or something in their garage on the weekends, or, you know, do some other kind of work that they don't consider work because they enjoy it. And so there's just a whole lot of stuff that people could do that I feel that we're kind of ignoring, and we're pretending it doesn't exist. We're pretending it isn't important. And I do think that we will start to see that. Yeah. And, you know, part of that is also kind of pointing it out too. And it's not just, it'll magically happen, but it's really, you know, it's like, let's say when we look at a pilot experiment for basic income, I think an important element of that is to actually define work as, you know, real as all work, you know, as work, and not so if there's a decrease in employment or something, then that experiment could say that, oh, well, you know, it affects work because it reduces work because people did less work because they did less jobs. But at the same time, like, what work, what did they do? So if someone say quits their job, and so what is it that they're doing? And so if they're quitting their job to, say, take care of an elderly relative or something, then that's care work, and that's valuable, and it's obviously something that, you know, you could pay someone to do. It is somebody's job to work in healthcare in that way, but this person is doing it for free because they would rather do it. It's important to them to do. And so I consider that as work. It's not a reduction of work. Like, let's say you were working a 40-hour job, and then you quit that and you went home to do care work, and that was, say, 50 hours a week. Well, see, I would say that was a 10-hour per week increase in work, because of that shift. Whereas if you didn't look at that, and you would say, oh, well, that was a loss of 40 hours per week in work. And that's just, so it really depends on how you define work. And I think that we should really expand the way that we define work to everything that we, you know, is valuable. Hmm.
I think something's going to have to happen, especially if, you know, there is a level of pain, or if there is a level of, let's just say it does happen in the sense that, you know, 40% are suddenly out of work. I think there, which is strange, you know, it's hard to poo-poo it. It's hard to look at it and say, oh, forget about it. I'm a fiscal conservative, and I think that's horseshit. Where, you know, you don't know where you're going to be in, you know, in this case, 15 years, maybe 20 years. I think it's strange that there's a slight tinge of libertarian in it, in that it takes the onus from the government saying, this is what you need or these are your needs, and we will provide them for you, versus here's the means, and you come up with your needs.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's really important element, because people are just, they're very creative. You know, we don't give people the credit of being as creative as they are. You know, and that's if you look at experiments where, you know, any cash transfer study to see like what people actually use it on, people are come up with some really interesting things that no government would have ever had a program for or something. And if they did, you know, it all require all sorts of bureaucracy and stuff involved. So like in GiveDirectly, it is an interesting example where somebody used their payment to actually buy a power saw, and they started a business with that power saw. They were, you know, cutting down wood and selling it and stuff. And you know, that was, you're not going to have a charity. There's no charity for power saws. You're not going to, there's not a government program out there handing out power saws to people who want it. Cause you know, you have people cutting off their hands. That's crazy. You know, it's so dangerous. You know, but the government does not know what people exactly need. And so we have these programs set up very paternalistically, and even the incentive structure itself is wrong, because what you're doing is saying that you only get this help, and this help is what I say this help is because I know what's best for you, and you only get it if you don't earn enough money and continue not earning enough money. So people are punished essentially for earning money because they lose that benefit, whatever it is, you know, if it's important to them to get, because it's the only thing that they can have. Is it all the incentives of that are all wrong? So you know, what we want to do is just create a floor for everybody where there's enough income that people can use to actually get what they most need, which may be, you know, a certain type of food that's not covered by food stamps. Like maybe somebody wants to eat Soylent. Like I love Soylent personally. And so, you know, that's not covered by food stamps. So it's not, that's the government saying that, no, I know what's best for you. And it's not that, or it's saying that, or even there's, you know, saying, oh, well, you're not allowed to eat lobster or steak or these kind of things. That's, you know, that's too much fun as far as eating goes for you. You deserve to actually suffer. Here's like gruel is what you deserve.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's an expansion of options, and people can, you know, let's say there's so much more flexibility. So if you're getting, let's say, $200 in food stamps and say $400 or say $500 or something in rental assistance or something like that, and let's say you're short on something like for rent or whatever, you're coming up $100 short, but you can't use any of the food money to do that. You know, there's no flexibility there, and so you're kind of screwed, and then you can go down this kind of downward spiral of just getting worse and worse off. Whereas if you just have that flexibility and say, hey, well, I'm just going to shift some of the food money over to this month, get that covered, and I'll be back on track next month, then that's like, you know, that's a huge improvement for people. And so aside from this ability to actually use money in more creative and more flexible ways, then you also create this new incentive mechanism where any amount of paid work that you do benefits you. There is no such thing as losing out, because you don't lose any of the basic income because it's unconditional. So no matter how much you do, you'll always be better off on top of it, whereas right now you're worse off. So it really is a switching around of this stuff. And I think that when it comes to this, the reasoning for the government paternalism and this, the reasoning behind targeting, it's entirely counterproductive on both accounts. You're preventing people from making choices that would be better for them and even better for the economy, especially if you're, you know, starting a new business and stuff, then you have like actually seed capital, and you also have customers that can purchase from them. You know, that's another big component. So you just need to, we're being counterproductive in the current way that we think about assistance.
Sure. Well, there is a big conversation to be had about universal basic income. Scott, I want to say that you're well-versed on it, and if folks want to read about it, they can go to scottsantens.com, S-C-O-T-T-S-A-N-T-E-N-S.com, and you're on everything. I mean, you're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Reddit.
Yeah, yeah.
Reddit has taken so much of my, I want to say it's taken so much of my life away, but I've enjoyed the hours I've spent. There was a Finding Dory meme that was going around and said, oh, I finished looking at Reddit's front page. I wonder what's on Reddit's front page.
Yeah, Reddit, again, it's its own good example of people have actually, you know, creating this valuable resource. It's valuable work, and you don't think of it's valuable work. Like, you, if you write a comment to something, you know, then it's, oh, this is a fun comment. But like, there's so much you can learn, and so much people get from articles actually going to the comments. Like, there's so many times where I don't even necessarily care about what the article says. I just go right to the comments and say, so what is everyone saying about this? You know, like, is it crap? You know, is it true? What's their kind of summary of it? Like, and that's all this free work going on. It's just, and I value it, and I want more of that Reddit, out there. I want people to be free to do that.
Reddit can boost your ego and destroy it all in one day. I've gotten to the front page and downvoted 1,000 points all in the same day, and I'm like, man. All right, Scott.
Yeah, that happens.
Any closing words to the guests? I mean, the listeners, I said guests, you're the guest.
So check out the Basic Income community on Reddit. Stay up to date on the latest news about Basic Income on basicincome.org, because there's always just stuff going on all over the world, and that does a great job of keeping people in the loop. And also, just ask yourself, what would you do with a basic income? You know, what kind of changes would you make, if any? What what business would you start? Would you spend more time with your friends and family? Would you, you know, what is it that you envision that you could do with a basic income? And I just ask people to think about that.
Yeah. And, you know, politics aside, it's, I think one of the biggest problems with today is we are surrounding ourselves with like-minded individuals, and you're getting nothing out of that. It's through discourse that you actually come up with the answer. And if you're completely against basic income, if you're completely for it, you gotta listen to it, because in a few years, a decision's gonna have to be made, whether we like it or not. There's no if about technology and in the future. It's gonna be there. People like Elon Musk wouldn't be billionaires if that wasn't the case. So it's something we have to face, and and maybe it's through arguments and discussions that we can, you know, come up with something.
Yeah. And it's funny too. I say that basic income is not left or right, it's forward. And I think that's just very true of how you've got people from all over the political spectrum who like this, and you've got people from all over who don't like this. But the funny thing too is that you'll have a lot of people who don't like the idea because they think it's an idea from the other side. You know, so you've got like conservatives saying that, oh, that's a liberal idea, and you know, that's ridiculous because of that, and it'll never work, having no idea that it's was, you know, supported by Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek. And then you've got, you know, people on the other side, on the left, saying, oh, this is a neoliberal idea, I'm not going to support it. And it's like forgetting the fact that Martin Luther King Jr. was a big advocate for it. Yeah. And so there's reasons on both sides that we can get behind this and actually talk to each other as human beings who can actually agree on something for once, finally. And I think that's a really powerful argument for it as well, is just the fact that we can kind of cut through this divisive tribalism that we've developed politically over the past few decades.
Yeah, it's getting crazy out there. It's probably where half of my downvotes come from, are people who are against libertarians. All right. Well, yeah. Scott, thank you very, very much for your time. And
thanks for having me.
Good luck in the future, and hopefully maybe we'll see something come into fruition with this.
Yeah, and thanks for doing this stuff. Again, I really value all the stuff that people are doing, like when it comes to podcasts and vlogging and videos. And, you know, it's just the stuff that people should be doing is the stuff that they really enjoy doing. And, you know, it's important, sharing that with other people. That's where, like, the joy comes from. You know, people don't do this stuff just for money. It's to actually make a difference. And, you know, thank you for doing it.
Hey, no problem. You take care.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
Like us on facebook.com/WWI Podcast. and at WWI Podcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.